A million of them could be placed on a period at the end of a 10-point sentence. And zillions of them are now in the foods we eat. This leads us to ask, are nanoparticles safe to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 907th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Yokohama who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Michael.
Producer Dylan Thompson on the stories today. Dylan?
Morning, Michael.
Folks, nanoparticles are very small. How small, you ask? Well, we could put 1 million of them on a period at the end of a little 10-point sentence. This makes nanoparticles too small to be governed by the laws of classical physics, and yet too big to be governed by the laws of quantum physics. And thus the particles operate by rules of their own. And because nanoparticles operate by rules of their own, they can do things we see as being almost like magic. Things like resist heat, kill germs, confer strength without adding weight. And because nanoparticles can do other things other particles can't, they are rapidly finding their way into our food chain. The American Chemical Society Journal claims that nanoparticles are now used in 89 popular foods, including M&M's, Mementos, Dentine and Trident chewing gums, Nestle coffee creamers, Pop-Tarts, Kool-Aid, Jell-O, Betty Crocker cake frostings. Though we are now eating freely of the miraculous nanoparticles, we simply do not know how much about them. We find it difficult to detect nanoparticles in our food, and we do not have nanoparticles for judging their effects on our bodies. We just don't know what's going on. We don't have the tools to track them down. This leads us to ask, are nanofoods safe to eat? Well, here to help us shop for some answers today, we have Heather Millar, who is a journalist and author of Pandora's Boxes, an article we found in Orion magazine. Heather, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're a freelance journalist. What led you to pitch this story to Orion magazine?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. In fact, this story started about 5 years ago when I was having drinks. I used to live in New York City, and I was having drinks with a friend who was a lawyer and a corporate lawyer, and she said, oh, my God, I just went to some sort of seminar or meeting, and they said they're putting nanoparticles in all kinds of things. They're putting it in toothpaste and shampoo, and nobody knows what they're going to do. And so I just started a database. I no longer keep files. I have digital databases, and every time I saw something about nanoparticles, I just plunked it in that database, and it started to grow. And I was just waiting for patterns to emerge. And the thing that's most amazing about nanoparticles is they're not just used in food. They're used in medicine, and they're used in your tennis rackets, and they're used in hair dryers, and they're used in paint and bricks. And, you know, they're not just one thing. But a lot of people say that nanoparticles are going to be part of the next industrial revolution, probably along with biotech.
What kind of
because
sounds
they're
like
that transformational.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like the next industrial revolution is already going on, though. If these things are used so ubiquitously, it's almost like they're everywhere now.
They pretty much are everywhere. For instance, they're used in socks. If you put nano silver in socks, it makes the cells of bacteria just explode. And so then your socks don't stink.
That's quite an image, okay. I could just
exploding
bacteria in your socks, huh?
Well, hey, this will really get your attention. They put them in condoms for the same reason. They put nano silver in condoms.
Oh, now that's way out there.
Yeah, it got my editor's attention.
Uh-huh. So what was the pattern that you saw emerging in your...
The pattern that I saw emerging was just that these things are everywhere, and they're very different. They have amazing number of applications, and that we don't really have the regulatory or the scientific structure to deal with them. And so the problem is, when you're a journalist, if you come across something that's really complicated like this, it's hard to explain. You've got to find a good story to bring it alive. And so I just started talking to scientists around the country until I found a good story. And I came across Mark Wiesner at Duke University. He's the head of the Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology, which sounds very grand and actually is really groundbreaking. But he had a really hard time getting it started because everybody said, well, it's too early. We don't know if these things are dangerous. Why are we going to be studying them? And Mark's response was, well, that's the whole point. It's early. Shouldn't we study them now before they start to make problems like, you know, DDT or BPA or MTBE or, you know, the list is long.
Let's stop. That's a really interesting notion right there, because we've seen it in so many other cases. Most notably, the whole question of GMOs and genetically modified organisms. Why study something? It's substantially equivalent to everything else, so don't bug me, if
right.
you pardon the expression.
Right.
Don't look at it. And yet, if we're going to, you know, consider something brand new, and nanotechnology is brand new, is it not? I mean, we didn't do this back in George Washington time. So this
the field is only 10 or 20 years old.
So this is a brand new field. So the question of when do you look at something and study it and check its efficacy and see if it's safe to turn loose?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I wanted to make that, you know, lay that ethical question on the table, because there it is. When do you look at this stuff? So, and your scientist was getting the flack from all the other scientists. We're kind of on the fun end of the spectrum. Oh, my goodness, we have a new tool. Look at all of the fun things we can make with it. It's magic. It's magic.
Right. It's no fun to talk about, you know, the Sorcerer's Apprentice thought it was a really great thing to have a broom do his work for him until all the brooms, you know, multiplied and made lots of problems. So, you know, the thing about it, and what made the story, I thought, really cool is that at Duke, the Center for, it's called SAINT, the Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology, and it's run out of Duke, but it's really a coalition of several different universities, including Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and University of Kentucky and a bunch of others that I can't remember off the tip of my tongue. But the experiment they were doing at Duke was to create a bunch of boxes that were sort of like little miniature copies of nature. Because if you imagine, if something is so small that finding it would be like trying to find a needle in the Grand Canyon when the Grand Canyon is filled with straw. So that when something is that small, even
that's
removing
small.
It in a pond, yeah, it's super small.
That's small.
But even releasing it into a pond or, you know, your average wetland, there are some studies in North Carolina where they're trying to see what nanosilver does in wetlands, but it's just so big, it's really hard to manage that kind of experiment. So what they did at Duke is they created these little miniature wetlands. They're about, I don't know, three or four feet by about 8 feet, these are like big sarcophagi or giant horse troughs or something. And they have slant boards in each box, and there's a little pond, and there are plants and fish and wetland plants. And so it's the idea of making these little miniature copies of nature, I thought, was really great. It was just a great image. And so that gave me a story to begin to talk about this topic, because, you know, it's really hard to give an elevator speech for nanoparticles. First of all, people can't even agree on what they are. You know, like one of the problems, I was on another radio show about 10 days ago, and Mark Wiesner and some other experts were on, and we started talking about regulation, and I finally said to the scientists, you know, don't we have to start to begin to decide exactly what a nanoparticle is and begin to have a structure for at least tracking it and regulating it? And they all just avoided the question because these are all good people and brilliant scientists, but it's just such a difficult topic. And you can imagine, you know, the United States Senate and the House have a lot of other things that are more easily understandable.
Sure.
Like the fiscal cliff.
And yes, and there you go.
They'd much rather talk about that.
And, so, and you know, what you said is very interesting because producer Dylan Thompson here was talking about nanoparticles and people looked at him like he was some kind of crazy guy. What are you talking about? But we are talking about nanoparticles and we're talking about scientists who constructed some boxes and put an environment in these boxes and then sprayed nanoparticles on them. And that, what happened? That's what we're going to find out on the Food Chain Radio program with your host Michael Olson and Heather Millar, who is a writer of Pandora's Boxes, as seen in Orion Magazine. Do stay tuned right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Nano foods. My goodness, they're here. They're everywhere. They're really in McDonald's hamburgers. Is that true, Heather Millar?
I don't know if they're in McDonald's hamburgers. I think that they are used in the clamshell packaging.
Ah.
That is used in some fast food things. They're also used in to seal beer bottles. You can make very fine films out of nanoparticles. Mm-hmm. And if you ever opened an old beer and tried to take a sip of the stale beer, you can understand why you might want to do that.
Right.
Well, try to keep it fresher for longer.
One USDA scientist says that nanoparticles are now being used to create a film to coat fruits and vegetables with that will make the fruits and vegetables have a much greater shelf life, and that indeed some of these films are actually being used on organic foods.
Well, I'm not sure about that. That was not something that I scared up in my research, but it sounds really believable because they're it's so thin that you can't even imagine how thin it would be, and I can see how it would increase the shelf life. And the FDA has judged nanoparticles as what is it's called the GRAS, generally regarded as safe, given them that.
So that's the same thing they did with the genetically modified organisms, and they gave them GRAS status, and therefore no one needs to do any safety efficacy studies with them.
Right, and the thing is that they're generally regarded as safe, and the thing is that we don't have any idea. And I really don't want to say that, oh, my God, there's nanoparticles everywhere. Stop eating Pop-Tarts. Well, frankly, if you have a healthy diet, you probably shouldn't be eating Pop-Tarts anyway. But, or M&M's. But,
well, wait a minute. You're a mother, aren't you, Heather?
I am indeed.
You are a mother, and you have looked extensively at this whole issue, this whole question of nanoparticles. Would you feed your daughter a Pop-Tart?
No, but for lots of other reasons besides the fact that the frosting might have nanoparticles in it.
Okay.
I do think that nanoparticles are something that we need to be having a national conversation about. One thing that we haven't really talked about on this show yet is exactly what a nanoparticle is.
That's next on the list. So what is a nanoparticle?
Well, a nanoparticle, the simplest answer to that question is a nanoparticle is a very, very small object.
How small?
So how small? It is 1 billionth. Usually they range in size between 1 billionths of a meter and 100 billionths of a meter. So a way to think about this is that they are larger than an atom, right?
Mm-hmm.
But smaller, much smaller than a cell in your body. So, and what makes objects at this size range really neat and interesting to scientists and industrial developers of all kinds is that, as you said at the beginning of this program, the rules are slightly different at that size range. Gravity sort of fades into the background. The colors shift. But the most important thing, I think, is that I don't know how much your listeners remember from high school chemistry, but basically, when you think about the reactions that go on in your average chemical reaction, like if you mix gold with something, for instance, gold is famously non-reactive. And the thing is that when you have a chemical reaction, that reaction is only happening on the surface of each of the two things that you're mixing. Most of the molecules stay inside. Well, with a nanoparticle is so small that most of the molecules are on the outside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes nanoparticles much more reactive. So, for instance, we're talking about food on this show.
So it kind of goes through the surface, and there's nothing to stop it.
Well, no, it's not that it goes through the surface. It's that there's so much surface area on the particle that is able to react, that those molecules are available to react with something else. So it makes them more conductive, more reactive,
mm-hmm.
more makes colors change. It, for instance, I was starting to talk about aluminum cans. No one thinks of aluminum can as being dangerous, right? Because aluminum isn't really that reactive. But if you bring it to the nanoscale, aluminum powder, powder of aluminum nanoparticles is explosive and is used in explosives. So you can imagine gold, for instance, doesn't react, but if you make it if you bring it down to a nanoscale, it's very reactive. So, another example, carbon. Carbon is really soft. You think of the graphite in a pencil, right? Super soft. If you bring it down to the nanoscale and you zap it with a laser of heat, it rolls into a little carbon nanotube and becomes incredibly strong. And so that is, I know we're not talking about sports equipment, but it's put into all kinds of sports equipment. Carbon nanotubes are put into golf clubs and tennis rackets and bike frames and all that sort of thing.
Wow. So you described looking into a microscope and seeing, and it was a really wonderful analogy because it talked about night on the Tibetan plateau. Describe that for us.
Well, it was really neat. After I went and visited the boxes, I went down to one of the labs in the basement of the Center for Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology. And there's a guy there who is studying nanosilver and how it interacts with bacteria. Remember, we were talking about nanosilver. When you see antibacterial socks or antibacterial clothing, exploding socks, indeed. Well, it's not exploding the socks, it's exploding the bacteria in the socks.
Okay.
Anyway, so they have this what's called a dark field microscope, and I won't get into all the details of this, but it's a very fancy sort of microscope that can show you things at the scale. And when I looked through the microscope and he dosed a slide with a little bit of nanosilver that he was studying, and it was just so cool. It was like this whole other universe, on the slide and it just seemed so vast. And the silver nanoparticles kind of undulated, and they looked like stars. And if you've ever been in a really remote area of the Earth and looked up at the sky, it was kind of like that, except I wasn't looking up. I was looking down at this thing that was infinitesimally small. It was pretty amazing. And the other thing that I think that we need to talk about is that this nano world seems so weird, right? It seems so miraculous. It seems so scary, all those things all at once. But nanoparticles and nanotechnology have always existed. For instance, one of the things when I first talked to the scientists at SAINT, they told me that bacteria, they talk by caressing each other with nanowires. That's how they communicate. I just think that's just so awesomely, that is just like so awesomely cool, right?
So and, two bacteria, it's like a telephone wire. It's like the old tin cans with a string, right?
The way I think of it is like two octopi come together and kind of caressing each other with these wires that are on the outside, and they give each other information back and forth in that way. The other thing is that nano machines. There's a lot of talk about nano machines. These are still on the horizon. Probably 10 to 20, 30 years from now, we'll probably have actual nano machines that are made by man. But DNA, which is the basis of life on Earth, right? DNA is basically a nano machine that operates at that scale. So nanoparticles and nano things have always existed. It's just that we have not engineered them, right? And we haven't introduced them in giant numbers into various products, into the environment, et cetera. Let's talk about nano. I'm sorry to keep going on and on. I just want to say one more thing.
Sure.
It's just the nano silver, for instance, that they have, it's being used in a lot of different things. And so they're finding that nano silver is turning up in the sewage treatment plants in various places. And it interferes with some of the, because it kills bacteria. It interferes with some of the things that sewer plants rely on bacteria to break down waste so that it can be released. So, you know, that's a definite unintended consequence of having antibacterial.
Well, let me come back. I'd like to talk about how mankind picked up on the nanoparticle and where we're taking it. This is the Food Chain, right back with Heather Millar and you. Well, how does one find a nanoparticle when that nanoparticle would be like finding a needle in the Grand Canyon filled with hay? My goodness, impossible. How did we come to grips with these tiny particles and how to use them, Heather Millar?
Well, the first nanoparticle was really discovered in about 1985, and it was called the Buckminster fullerene, because it was a particle. I don't know if your listeners remember Buckminster Fuller.
Oh,
Buckminster,
yes.
Fuller, but he, you know, created the geodesic dome, and which looks like a dome that's made out of little hexagons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how this particular nanoparticle, the structure of it, looked like a geodesic dome. So they called them buckyballs. And for a long time, they couldn't really, they didn't know if buckyballs had any use, any application. They've since been found, I think, to be, memory serves, to be, they can act as superconductors, and they resist heat. And then a few years later, scientists at the Japanese company NEC discovered the carbon nanotube. And those are the things that I've mentioned in earlier segments that can confer great strength without adding weight. So if you add these little carbon nanotubes to a tennis racket, you can make the tennis racket much lighter and thinner but still strong if it has these nanotubes in it. And then that was about 20 years ago. And since then, new applications and new kinds of nanoparticles have been both discovered and fabricated at really quite a feverish rate.
And of course, they have become well used now in the food chain. Our food chain, 89 at least popular foods. But why? What do we do with nanoparticles in our food chain?
Well, nanoparticles, we were talking in earlier segments. The thing about them is that they're so tiny. If you stretch them out into a film, it's almost imperceptible to our senses. So you can, as you pointed out, someone at the USDA has found that you can put a film of nanoparticles over food to increase the shelf, I guess, produce. Is that
sure?
This is not my research; it's yours. But also, you can put nanotitanium dioxide most into food products to make them whiter and smoother. So most of the applications in the study that I cite in the article, those 89 food products, use nanotitanium dioxide to make things really white. So it makes your Mentos super white. And the nanoparticles are, you know, Mentos are white and the frosting and the Pop-Tarts and this and that.
Incidentally, there's a saying about food. When it comes to food, white could be beautiful, but mostly it's not.
I like that. That's funny. And so now there's a whole other reason to not have white bread, although I'm not saying that there's nanoparticles in your bread.
Yeah. But it is used to make things white.
Right. They use it to make things white, and they use it to make things fresher.
How do you make something fresher?
Well, not to make it fresher, but to keep it fresher.
Okay.
By creating these films.
Mm-hmm.
In the packaging.
What about flavor enhancement?
That is not something that I know about. My article really took the broad view. Food is definitely part of what I was researching, but I didn't go into it as deeply as I might have if that was the only topic of the piece.
Okay.
I don't know if it's used in flavoring.
One other thing is that we see that it's being used to carry nutrients or mineral elements and vitamins and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. They're being nanoparticles have wide applications in medicine because you can use a nanoparticle as a kind of like as a delivery system or a targeting system. So if you want to target cancer cells or whatever, you can use nanoparticles to do that. You can also use nanoparticles to deliver vitamins, as you say, and those have been introduced. So if you look at fortified, you know, things that have been fortified with this and that, you know, take all the nutrients out and then put them back in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so they are used in that application. I believe, now, don't hold me to this if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that in Europe that they're not allowed to be used in that application.
So they're kind of like the ultimate fortifier, right? I mean, not so much.
It's not so much that the nanoparticles are doing the fortifying. The nanoparticles are doing the delivering to your cells. Okay, so the thing is that nanoparticles. One of the things that makes them both cool and frightening is that nanoparticles are much, as I said before, they're larger than a molecule but much smaller than a cell. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So they can pass through membranes that other things can't.
Right.
So they can pass through the blood-brain barrier. They can pass through the lining of your gut.
Well, is there any lining or any membrane on the human body that they could not pass through? I mean, it's hard to
prove a negative, but my guess would be probably not. I mean, and there's no studies that these things are killing you, but there are studies in animals that show that, for instance, nanoparticles can harm the brains of fish. They can build up in your gut. They can sail. There's a study that shows that they can sail past the blood-brain barrier. There are studies that show that they can prematurely corrode metal. So they can do pretty powerful things. Or they also tend to build up in the food chain. So if you introduce, there was one study where they introduced gold nanoparticles and then tried to see, like, if something at the bottom of the food chain ate this gold nanoparticle, transferred up the food chain? And they found that, yes, indeed, it was. There's another study that shows that if you dose plants with a certain kind of nanoparticle, it can stunt their growth. But the thing to really that I just want to emphasize is that these are all different kinds of nanoparticles. So each study that I'm citing, it's not just gold or just carbon nanotubes or just titanium dioxide. It's all different things being studied. And what we know about them is really quite little if you really think about how widely they've been introduced.
You know, this is starting to sound like the wild, 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 wild west of biotechnology here. Because it all comes down to this really funny question. How do the manufacturers of food that use nanoparticles in their food, how do they control something that operates by its own rules?
Well, I don't think you know that they do. I mean, I don't think because they're not being asked to do that, and because they're difficult to define, and they're already being introduced, the regulators are having a terrible time figuring out exactly how to even talk about regulating them. So there are some regulations in Europe, and there are some in China, and some have been introduced in Russia. India is talking about it, but hasn't really done anything. And there's a robust sort of among policy geeks, there's a robust conversation going on. But it's a shame that there's not a wider conversation going on
regular people. That's what we're starting right here and right now, Mike. And we're doing it on the Food Chain Radio program. Mike Lolson with Heather Millar. The subject, nanoparticles in your food. Are you hungry yet? Right back. Well, folks, imagine having a smelly pair of socks and not knowing what to do with your smelly socks. They offend everybody in the gym, and you have to figure out what to do. Well, now you can buy smelly sock-fixing nanoparticles, by golly, and you sprinkle some of those nanoparticles on your socks, and the stinky, smelly bacteria simply explode, and you have exploding socks. Well, that's the world of nanoparticles, and we're using nanoparticles in all kinds of things that we manufacture for our living purposes, but also we're putting it in our foods, and lots of foods. Lots of the foods that we go to the convenience store to buy now have these particles in them. So small, particles so small, to find one, it would be like finding a needle in a Grand Canyon filled with hay. Incredible small. So the question, I guess, is how do we come to grips with managing this as a people? We've turned them loose on the food chain, and away they go. You call them Pandora's boxes, I guess, and that's the is that the name that you gave to the scientific study that you observed, Heather?
Yes, Michael. The study that I wrote about was an experiment at Duke, where they created little miniature boxes and put models of nature in them and introduced, you talked about nanosilver. By the way, you can't sprinkle nanosilver on socks. The socks come with the nanosilver already
in them.
But they do indeed make bacteria explode. So then the bacteria don't make your socks stink. But anyway, the scientists, created 30 of these boxes with little miniature models of a southeastern wetland in them, and then introduced nanosilver into them to see what would happen.
Now, did you call them? Don't tell us the answer yet.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
Don't spill the beans.
It took a long time to answer.
Okay.
The answer is that I wrote this pitch, and the editors at Orion immediately said they're like Pandora's boxes, uh-huh. And it took about 6 months to put this piece together.
Sure.
And during that time, we all talked about it as Pandora's boxes, and that just stuck.
Now, why did you call them Pandora's boxes? For those of us,
well, because the experiment is done in a bunch of boxes, and if everybody would remember Pandora, it's a classical myth, I believe a Greek myth, in which Pandora is asked not to open a box, and she can't keep herself from being curious about opening the box, and she does open the box, and then all the ills of the world, you know, greed and dishonesty and war and disease and everything come out of this box, and that's why there are problems in the world. And the experiment was on these boxes, and the thing is that nanoparticles have the potential to be incredibly useful, mm-hmm. but they also have the potential to be dangerous, to be not such a great thing. You know, they're really a double-edged sword.
Well, and right now we seem to be focusing totally on, oh my goodness, we have this new tool, let's have fun. Let's
exactly
let
right.
it rip, and let's rebuild the world with nanoparticles, and that seems to be what we're doing. But again, we go back to this notion of having a particle that kind of acts up by its own rules and its own rules and regulations. It's too big to operate by the rules of quantum mechanics, too small to operate by the rules of classical physics. So it's kind of operating in its own little world there. But how do we get a hold of this and stick it in a loaf of bread, if that's what, or a pair of socks, or how do we manage this stuff?
Well, I don't, you know, I think that that is a question to which there is no answer yet. I don't know that we are even trying to manage it. One of the things that they're doing at the Center for the Environmental Implications of Nanotechnology, this consortium of universities that I write about in the story, is that they are trying to develop a library that catalogs all the different kinds of engineered nanoparticles. As we talked about earlier in the show, nanoparticles have always existed in nature. For instance, there are nanoparticles in the smoke of a fire. But there have never before been engineered nanoparticles that we have created to do particular things that we think are cool, like make things antibacterial or smoother or clearer. Like, for instance, if you think about, there's a huge debate, not so much in this country, but in Australia, about sunscreen. Remember, you know, I'm old enough to remember when lifeguards had white noses.
Right.
Well, you don't see that anymore, do you?
No.
And the reason you don't is because they've taken the zinc oxide, which is that white stuff that people use on their noses to not get sunburned. They have made that into nanoparticles and put it into the sunscreen, and at that size, it still blocks the sun, but the human eye can't see it. So you don't have to look like a moron with a white nose on the beach. You can look normal.
But these particles are so small, don't they just like go right through your skin and right through your blood and right through your bones and right through, I mean, what's stopping?
I don't think we know the answer to that question. There are, I'm just throwing out a number here, maybe 100 or 200 studies done on the biological implications of these particles. But if you think of how many places they're being introduced, there's just not nearly enough work being done. And what I was starting to say earlier in the show is that seems so cool that these scientists at Duke and Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and all these famous universities are sort of studying this, but you think about their work, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm just guessing that they probably have somewhere between $5 and $10 million that they're using.
Hold that thought. We have to go take a quick break. 831-479-1080. Call us up right back. Well, sometime in the near future, we're going to turn these little nanoparticles into nanobot machines and turn them loose into the world. But that creates a problem called gray goo. What are they talking about, Heather Millar? What is gray goo?
Gray goo is an image that Sun Microsystems founder Bill Joy wrote about in Wired magazine about 10 years ago. And his vision, or the question he was asking, was that if we release self-assembling and self-replicating nanomachines into the environment, they could spread like pollen or bacteria, and they might be too tough and too small to stop before they invaded every part of the biosphere, chewing it up and reducing all life on Earth to gray goo. Now, nobody really knows whether this is a prophetic vision or a hysterical one, but it's certainly worth talking about.
Certainly.
And I don't think we do nearly enough of that.
Well, let's go quickly to the phones. Annalise, are you there?
Yes, thank you very much for your fascinating discussion. This sounds very much like a conversation they had last Saturday at 1 o'clock on aluminum particulates that was being discussed as part of what is in the chemtrails mm-hmm. that we all see in the sky.
And that's what young Dylan here, when he was doing his research, that he said that chemtrails came up all the time.
Right, and these particulates are so tiny that we're breathing them in, they're going into our lungs, they're actually permeating and going through the lungs into the bloodstream, and aluminum is not exactly a friendly substance for us to be taking in. It is part of the metals that we have in nature, but we're not meant to have that brought to our attention by breathing it. The question I have...
Go ahead.
Excuse me?
Go ahead.
The question I have is, you know, how do we ever get a hold of this, Heather, where... Is it Heather Millar?
Yes, Heather Millar.
Heather Millar, yes.
Thank you. Where the good or the negative and positive application of this is more carefully studied, we can't rely on the FDA to do that. We already have too much history. So how do we get a hold of this so that so much is not being done to us where we don't even know what's happening? They don't even know, because as you were explaining, these particles operate by their own rules. It's almost like a teenager, not old enough to really handle.
I didn't think of that. I would have put that in
that's
my story
good.
If I thought of that.
Okay.
Thank you, Annalise. So that's the question of the day. How do
right.
we know? How do we know?
Well, not only that, how do we get a hold of it so we're not... We can't seem to counter it. I asked Ben Fuchs about that when he was talking about our health and how do we get a hold of it so it's not adversely affecting us. We
thank you very much,
that.
Annalise.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. What do you think, Heather?
Frankly, I think that the only way that we are going to get a hold of this, I mean, is, first of all, to support scientists like the ones I wrote about in my story mm-hmm. and have them do more research, but also the public needs to start demanding that more research be done.
Okay, really quickly, what happened in the Pandora's boxes when they sprayed the silver nanoparticles? What happened?
Well, what they did is they after they sprayed the silver in, there's a way to track where the silver goes by looking for certain kinds of chemical reactions, and so they had all kinds of sensors set up to see, like, if you spray it, where does it go? If you release it into the soil, where does it go?
What happened?
You have to release it into, and so what they found is that it tends to stay put if it's in the soil. And they also found go ahead.
That it eats up everything and it keeps eating up everything, correct?
Well, no, it doesn't eat up everything. It eats up the bacteria.
Out of time, Heather Millard. Thank you for joining us on The Food Chain, and thank you all for tuning in. See you next time.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.